opened up the Senate Committee on Business and Transportation for a sunny Wednesday, March 11th. Thank you all for coming to our committee meeting today. We like it when we have company. Let's open up a public hearing on House Bill 2250. Mr. Stembridge.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, House Bill 2250 deletes prohibition against issuing full on-premises sales license to a winery licensee that is owned or controlled by a distillery. It exempts appointing distillery retail outlet agents from prohibition against retail sales agents from having to a financial interest or a business connection with a distillery. It corrects statutory inconsistencies relating to OLCC distillery license, and it clarifies the number and locations where distilleries may conduct tastings.
Thank you. Donna Vandal from OLCC.
Thank you.
Did I pronounce that correctly?
Yes. Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Donna Vandal. I'm the Technical Services Coordinator for the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of HB 2250. Essentially, what this bill does is to make a number of technical corrections to the distillery license statute, which is ORS 471-230, and to related provisions of the Brewery Public House and Winery License statutes to eliminate inconsistent terminology, clarify terms, and clarify concepts relating to distillery privileges. The bill also eliminates a potential conflict in the statutes that could be construed to prohibit a distillery retail outlet agency from having an interest in a distillery, even though ORS 471-230 specifically allows a distillery to be appointed as an agent. By way of background, the distillery license statute was amended in 2007 to expand the privileges available to Oregon distilleries, including allowing distilleries to provide sample tastings and to obtain an additional license to operate a full-service restaurant at the distillery. This bill clarifies some inconsistencies that had resulted from prior amendments to the distillery license statute and the related statutes. It also reflects changes in terminology and practice, including the establishment by OLCC of a separate category of distillery retail outlet agents who sell only products manufactured by the distillery. The bill does not alter the privileges currently available to distilleries or wineries or brew pubs. The specific changes that the bill makes are that it clarifies the number and location where distilleries may conduct tastings. It revises terminology to distinguish between retail sales agents who can sell a wide variety of products and distillery retail outlet agents that only sell the products of that particular distillery. It changes the term distilled to manufactured in the statute. It clarifies that a brewery public house licensee that also holds a distillery license may become a distillery retail outlet agent, and clarifies that a distillery licensee that also holds a winery license may hold a full on-premises license. The bill also amends ORS 471-710 regarding retail agents to update language to reflect current terminology and practice. It clarifies that the prohibitions in that statute do not apply to a distillery retail outlet agent appointed by the commission. So in summary, this bill will provide additional clarification to licensees, applicants for licenses or agent contracts, commission staff, and others regarding the distillery license privileges. It doesn't change current policy, but eliminates the potential for confusion and may reduce staff time required to process applications and address questions from licensees and applicants. The bill passed the House on February 23rd on a vote of 51-0. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Vandal. Do you have any questions from the committee? You may remember when we had this bill, I called it the Bend Distillery Bill, as I recall,
yep,
last session, to allow on-premises tastings.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, any concerns with the committee? I think this looks pretty technical as we can get for things. All right, close the public hearing and open a work session on House Bill 2250.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 2250 has the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2250 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? I see it's related to licensees. Should we put in, like, agent commissions in this bill? Oh, no, we won't do that. Any objections? So ordered. Anybody want to carry distilled liquor?
Distilled liquor.
Okay. I guess I do. Public hearing on House Bill 2251. Mr. Stembridge.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, House Bill 2251 allows Oregon Liquor Control Commission to a service permit applicant to have an application endorsed by an OLCC employee.
Mr. McNeil, welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dan McNeil. I'm the licensing manager for the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, and I'm here to speak on behalf of House Bill 2251. Essentially, for some background, this bill deals with a service permit application. A service permit is the permit that a person gets if they want to sell alcohol at a licensed business. That would be like a person who's a bartender or an alcohol server. Now, currently, part of our service permit application is a requirement for an endorsement on the application. And that endorsement essentially is somebody's verifying, independent of the applicant, the person's age and identity. Now, under our current laws, there are four groups that can, types of people that can endorse that application. The first is a licensee of the commission, somebody who's got a liquor license through us. The second is approved temporary staffing agency personnel. That's a temporary staffing agency that essentially uses temporary staff to provide caterers or bartender services. The third is the providers of our alcohol server education course, which is part of qualifying ultimately to get an approved permit. And finally, there's OLCC designated staff can sign those. Now, there's a constraint on OLCC staff that doesn't apply to the other people. In order for our staff currently to endorse that application, we have to verify that the person is employed, and secondly, we have to verify that they have both taken and passed the alcohol server education class. And again, those provisions don't apply to these other people who can endorse it. Now, the background behind why the law has that constraints is that in 2001, when this statute, ORS 471-375, was revised, we opened it up. Prior to 2001, a person had to be employed, and only a licensee could sign that application. We opened this up because people were coming to us and saying, hey, I'd like to get a service permit application before I get a job to make myself more marketable. We had questions coming in from temporary employment agencies that wanted to provide employees to work at these temporary events, but they weren't a licensee and couldn't sign the application. And while we looked at that, we looked at opening it up for OLCC staff, too, but we put the conditions in here because we just weren't sure how many people would be coming through our door. We were concerned that we might just get a flood of people and we wouldn't be able to handle it with our staff. Well, our experience since 2001 has shown that that's really not the case. In fact, we get a few applicants coming in to have their applications endorsed, but it's something that our staff can easily handle. So we see that there's really not a need for that constraint. And the problem is, as the law is currently written, somebody may come into our office. They'll take a bus in. I mean, a lot of times alcohol servers aren't, you know, highly paid. They take a couple of hours to take a bus to our office, come to our office to get their application endorsed, and because they haven't already taken the class or because they've got a job with somebody else, we have to turn them away at that point. And so what we'd really like to do is provide better customer service by amending the law and essentially taking those constraints away. So our staff would be able to endorse an application just like anybody else. Overall, we believe this is a good idea. It helps us provide better service to our constituents, and I don't think there's any cost or problems involved with this. So we are here to support that. I did want to note that this did pass through the House February 12th. The vote was 54-0. So
you got three more votes than Ms. Vandal did. Well, sounds like this is a bill that expands the market to entrance for more people. So I know who's going to carry this bill. Any questions? Okay. Let's open up a work session on House Bill 2251.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2251 to Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2251 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Is there any objection? Senator George, would you carry this bill?
That feeling.
Okay, let's open up a public hearing on House Bill. Oh, no, hold it. Hold on a second. We've got an honored guest in the audience. We'll go a little bit over. Let's open up public hearing on Senate Bill 469.
Yes, several honored guests.
Well, we got lots of honored guests. Thank you for correcting me. You're all honorable. It's amazing what a few votes will do that makes us honorable. Oh, Senator Atkinson, you're the honored guest. Why don't you tell us about 469, Jim?
Mr. Chairman, Senate Bill 469 exempts individuals 16 years of age and younger from requirement to obtain a business license.
Welcome, Senator Atkinson.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jason Atkinson, State Senator from Southern Oregon. This particular bill is a constituent bill. The constituents that have brought this to my attention cannot be here today because they are in school. And their mothers who called me on this issue could not be here today because they are picking them up from school. This isn't exactly the biggest, most important piece of policy that you will ever vote on. However, what this bill does is it simply allows kids to be kids who are involved in trying to make a buck. Believe it or not, a municipality in Oregon harassed some children who had, believe it or not, a lemonade stand. And I told their parents that I would introduce this bill. It's actually an issue that does come up more often than you might think, not just with lemonade stands and kids that are trying to make money, but also various nonprofit groups like the Boy Scouts, youth groups, volleyball teams, etc., that do car washes, bake sales, and the rest. When you live in a more rural area, oftentimes those volleyball teams and youth groups and whatnot will go to various towns. They'll go from one to one to one to one to try to make sales. And what this bill attempts to do is that you can do that. The area that this infraction occurred was in one small town that a member of the I think it was Planning Commission or something. Planning Council. It was a city employee, if I recall correctly, brought this up and said that they had to shut down this lemonade stand. But two streets over in another little small town that could have done it. So anyway, as silly as it sounds, I am keeping my word and trying to help young entrepreneurs. Now, the other reason for this is I'm growing one of these myself. The other day, I came home and put 50 cents on my dresser here in Salem. And my son saw it and demanded that he have the 50 cents. And I said, no, cannot have the 50 cents. He says, I will work for it. I will set the table. To which I said, no, you set the table anyway. To which he said, I will clean my room for it. I said, no, you clean your room anyway. He says, how do I earn the money? The most brilliant question a young man can ask. To which I said, you can wash my bike, son. But if I find one holiday on it, which is a place where you miss a spot, no money. So my bike was perfectly clean. It cost me 50 cents, and I'm growing an entrepreneur. So anyway, that's what we're trying to do with this bill, and I would urge an aye vote.
So tell me, what's the current status of the lemonade?
Shut down. They are back in the sixth grade, just discouraged. And fortunately, this is not the top sale season for lemonade stands. Don't laugh, Senator Schrader. I see you holding it back. You'll learn to miss me in this committee.
Thank you. We have questions for Senator Atkinson. Good.
I don't have a question, just a comment that I raised five entrepreneurs, and
yes.
In my hometown, they could sell lemonade on the street. So,
well,
if this is a problem in your hometown, we better fix it.
Okay. It's a few towns over from my particular home, yes, there are, and I don't mean to smirk, but there are several mothers that are watching me right now, watching me keep my word, Senator Schrader.
Other questions for Senator Atkinson? Senator Berger.
I also have a comment to make. I think with technology, you're going to see more entrepreneurs doing very interesting things. I don't know that it falls under this bill, but I happen to know of a young person about this age who has created a nonprofit and is taking instruments, musical instruments, and sending them to countries, foreign countries, where children cannot, don't have access to musical instruments. So I think that there are young entrepreneurs, and I think this is just fine. I do notice that the bill says that they would operate as a sole proprietor, which I think is a good idea, and under their real name. So
I thought you're correct. I getting sixth graders to go to a subchapter S quarterly meeting, I think, could be problematic. but as sole proprietors, being entrepreneurialism 101, I'm all for it. I think it's a good bill, actually. And I'm very flattered that you'd give me 10 minutes to explain it, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions for Senator Atkinson?
Mr. Chair, I will tell you in conclusion that I'm highly disappointed in Senator George and Senator Starr for not coming up with this fantastic opportunity to ask me questions, but I'm thankful that you were keeping them in line, and with that, I thank you very much for hearing the bill.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Senator George, I think you sparked something.
Yeah.
You were doing so well.
Comment. I just want to thank the senator for allowing us to participate as signing on to the bill.
Oh, would you like to sign on?
No, I think we did.
Oh,
hey,
look, yeah. You actually asked me, and I think I signed on.
Oh, that's good.
I didn't want to brag about it. It's a brilliant idea that I signed on to. But I got to say, anything to take the heavy boot of regulation off the future of this country is something that really inspires me, and I appreciate your work on this.
Thank you. I'm sure that comment will cost me in the future. Thank you very much, Mr.
Thank you.
Chair.
Well, colleagues, we have not heard from anyone on this bill. You know, all the great forces that would tell us why they'd have to get a local business license for someone under 17 years of age. And, of course, there is an exception in the bill for, it doesn't mean they don't have regulated, but it just don't have to buy a business license. What is the wish of the committee? We're in just public hearing at the moment.
Good bill.
Close public hearing. Open work session.
We don't have a work session posted, Mr. Chair.
We don't.
We'll
unfortunate.
Bring this back.
Right. We'll close the public hearing and we'll set a work session next week.
I think lemonade season will.
lemonade hasn't come yet. But I think you're doing well. So thank you. That's right. Now let's go back to our regular order of business and open up public hearing. House Bill 2252. Thank you for reminding me that.
Apologize, Mr. Chairman. House Bill 2252 has to do with the Public Utility Commission's Telephone Residential Service Protection Fund. It basically extends the sunset and it makes some minor changes to the eligibility.
Okay, so Mr. Beyer, Chairman of the OPUC, and Ms. Wells.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senators. For the record, I'm Lee Beyer, Chairman of the Oregon Public Utility Commission. And this isn't nowhere near as exciting as the lemonade stands, but it is important.
Well, we might be asking you to set, you know, rates for, you know, regulate the lemonade stands to make sure they're market.
Pass on
Mr.
Chair. Mr. Chair. In 1987, the legislature stated that it is the policy of this state to assure that adequate, affordable residential telecommunication service is available to all citizens of the state. And having stated that, they established the Residential Service Protection Program, which has been in continuous service since then. It has been sunsetted four times. This would be the fifth time that it's up for an extension. And we obviously are going to advocate that you do that. I think it's a valuable service to the citizens of this state. The Residential Service Protection Fund has four elements to it. As the Oregon Telecommunications Relay Service that allows us as hearing individuals to call people who have a hearing impairment through a relay service and communicate with them. The telephone assistance program is a second element. It provides assures that basic telephone service is available to low-income customers who meet fairly tight eligibility requirements. The third element is the device assistance program. This is something that actually some members of the legislature have taken advantage of. It provides, or we loan equipment to people with hearing disabilities or physical disabilities so that they have access to that telecommunication and can contact others. And then the fourth element is the emergency medical certificates program. This essentially is a facilitation to allow people who are under the care of a qualified professional and might be having trouble paying their bills to set up payment plans to assure that they can continue to have that service. These programs are funded by a monthly surcharge on phone lines. By statute, the maximum fee allowed is 35 cents per month per line. The charge currently is 9 cents, and the Commission reviews this charge annually and adjusts it as necessary to assure that there's never more than 6 months of projected needs in the fund, so it doesn't get overly large. That's a statutory requirement. We were one of the few states that implemented these programs before they were federally mandated. In 1990, the Americans with Disabilities Act mandated accessible telephone service for hearing and speech disabled Americans. This resulted in the telecommunications relay service. The FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, holds telephone companies responsible for providing this service. However, since the commission was providing these previously, we do not have to have the companies themselves provide it, and they view that as a benefit of the program. They think it's more cost-effective to do that through a centralized means. Both of these, all of these programs fall under a couple of advisory groups that we have. One represents industry and one represents the user group. Both of them are very strongly in support of this bill. Currently, there is no opposition to the bill that we know of. No one spoke in opposition to the House, and members of the industry are very supportive of it, as I said. There are two other elements to the bill besides just extending this. First has to do with Medicaid recipients in residential or long-term care facilities. The current program requires that to get benefits, they have to have income levels that do not exceed 135% of the federal poverty level. And although their income may technically exceed the allotted amount, most of the money of some of these individuals goes to the facility. That's a requirement of Medicaid, that if you're in it, that the money, except for a limited amount, goes to the facility, not to the individual. And so they are limited under the current restriction from getting that service. We think we should remove that and make it available to anybody who's in one of these facilities. The second portion of current law restricts telecommunication device access program to loaning adaptive telephone equipment only to those who have a severe or a greater hearing or speech impediment. This bill will allow us to loan the equipment to a broader segment of the hearing and speech impaired community as determined by a licensed medical professional. We believe in our practices is that the people who are in the hearing business are pretty good. They understand if they need the service or not, and far better than setting up some kind of complex technical standard to do that. So that's it, Mr. Chair. It's a fairly simple bill. Again, it came out of the House with no opposition. We encourage you to support and pass this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Questions from the committee? Senator Verger.
I have a question about the expansion of the service, which I think is very appropriate, but I also am concerned that that means you're going to increase the fee on the phone line. Would that not be the case?
Mr. Willis.
Mr. Chair, Senator, for the record, my name is Rick Willis with PUC. You're talking about broadening for the Medicaid. Is that the group that you're referring to, Senator?
No, just expanding the service to more people that have a hearing impairment or a speech problem. And right now you're below what you're allowed to charge. And so my question is, if you're approved to expand the service, are you going to also up the fee?
Mr. Chair, Senator, slightly. That is, we estimate it'll cost approximately $167,000 to service those folks. That comes out to 0.2 cents. So at this point, it's lost in rounding. But technically, yes, it is a little bit more money, and at some point, it does raise it at 0.2 cents.
Senator.
Thank you. I've got a question about the section, paragraph 8 and paragraph 13 of section 3. You say in your testimony that that the bill allows you to loan equipment to a broader segment of the hearing and speech impaired community as determined by a licensed medical professional. So I read this, you also include a vocational rehabilitation counselor of DHS. Are we assured that the vocational rehabilitation counselor at DHS is a licensed medical professional?
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, we have been using them all along for the severely impaired. They have done a wonderful job so far. We have no reason to believe that they wouldn't in the future. Really what this is doing is currently folks are limited to severe hearing impairments, and that's a term of art. That's X amount of decibels that they can't hear. We're just trying to lower the bar a little bit because there are folks that are right under that who could really use the service, but right now are not allowed. And yes, our experience with those folks is they do a wonderful job of working with the individuals, determining their hearing needs, and we believe they will continue to do that even with the lower bar. Does that answer your question?
No. Are they licensed medical professionals, as you say, as Mr. Byer said in his testimony?
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, they are, it's my understanding, they are licensed. They are not doctors, but they are licensed or have a certificate, is my understanding.
But are they medical professionals?
Mr. Chair, Senator, it's... Mine said that they're not MDs, but they are in the medical field. So I don't know if that's a term of art, if someone with less than an MD, if a nurse is called a medical professional, for example.
I don't know. You just the words in the bill and the words in the testimony don't seem to jive. So I'm just trying to make sure we know what we're...
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, I appreciate your comment, and I think what you want to focus on in terms of that is what's in the bill. Those are the people we're talking about. In writing testimony, I would consider those medical professionals, but they're certainly not doctors, but licensed therapists, those kinds of things. They are people who have expertise in the area of hearing and have, my understanding, licensed or certificated by the state to make those kinds of determinations.
Perfect. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay, that's closed public hearing on House Bill 2252. We will be bringing this back for a work session after a little bit. Okay, so the public hearing on Senate Bill 639. Mr. Stembridge.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 639 has to do with the reorganization of the Oregon Wheat Commission. Many provisions in it, and I think that's all I'll say.
Okay. It is interesting. I have Jeff Newton and Katie Colbert signed up, but we also have Attorney Hur also.
I should mention, the members, that we have the -3 amendment and a -2 amendment. The -2 amendment is just fixes a Scrivener's error. The -3 amendment, I believe, has been distributed. And you have a hand-engrossed version of the -3 also.
Okay, thank you. Who wants to kick us off?
I will.
Okay.
Good afternoon. My name is Jeff Newton. I'm the 2009 president of the Oregon Wheat Growers League. I'm also a farmer who lives north of Pendleton. The Oregon Wheat Growers League represents more than 4,000 wheat and barley producers and landowners who farm nearly 1 million acres out of 17 tillable acres in the state of Oregon. Wheat producers of Oregon contribute on average nearly $400 million to the state's economy each year, and the total amount contributed by Oregon's agriculture sector exceeds $5 billion this last year. You may find it interesting to note that $5 billion, just the farm gate value, is more than 200, represents more than 200 crops raised in Oregon. These figures do not include the wages, the taxes, the goods purchased to plant and harvest crops, or the capital improvements to the farming operations. I am here today to speak in favor of Senate Bill 639, which represents a collaborative industry and agency effort to enhance the existing enabling statute for the Oregon Wheat Commission, ORS Chapter 578. Prior to reviewing the enhancements with you, I'd like to take a couple of moments to provide you with a brief history of the Oregon Wheat Commission. The Wheat Commission was established in 1947 upon the request of the Oregon Wheat Growers League. The Oregon Wheat Commission was the first industry wheat industry checkoff in the United States. The forefathers of the Oregon's wheat industry recognized that a voluntary checkoff program would not support the research, the market development, and the public education campaigns necessary to ensure the long-term sustainability of the industry. Sustainability would only be ensured by a mandatory checkoff, collected at the first point of sale on every bushel of wheat grown in Oregon. Every wheat producer has the ability to sell their crop or portions thereof at their discretion. However, when they do choose to sell, the grain elevator is statutorily mandated to then collect assessment and forward that commensurate portion of to the Oregon Wheat Commission office in Portland. More than 60 years later, the Oregon wheat industry continues to lead the nation crafting wheat-related policies. In fact, the new president of the National Association of Wheat Growers is Carl Skrantz, who is a farmer in Klamath Falls. Just to be clear, the Oregon Wheat Growers League was created in 1926 and caused the commission to be created by statute in 1947.
The two entities are governed separately by two distinct boards of directors. The commission falls under the Oregon Department of Ag oversight. The Oregon Wheat Growers League is the advocacy arm of the wheat industry and therefore accepts the responsibility of shepherding this legislative enhancement efforts through this session. Now to the enhancements. I've attached a red line marked up version of the original bill, and we can go through that really quickly. It's basically what on pages probably 3 and 4 of your handout. Some of the corrections, as was just stated earlier, are delineated there. Section 12 and Section 13 in the bill are actually X'd out, and the corrections are made talking about the administrator and also commission duties and authorities and powers. As you can see, I've got Director Koba with us from the Department of Agriculture, and her assistant Lauren Henderson is also in the room to support the revisions that we've included in Chapter 578 of the ORS legislation. The swift passage of Senate Bill 639 will allow the Oregon Wheat Commission to continue to efficiently and effectively collect assessments from wheat producers and direct those funds to priority programs focused on research, market development, and public education for years to come. The Oregon Wheat Growers League and the Oregon Wheat Commission support Senate Bill 639 and request its passage by this committee. Thank you for your time and service to Oregon. I will gladly take your questions.
Thank you. I think we'll move on to Ms. Koba.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Katie Koba, Director of the Oregon Department of Agriculture. We are here today to indicate our support for Senate Bill 639. We've worked with the Commission and the League in putting the revisions in place that we think are appropriate, and certainly can also answer any questions that you might have about the Wheat Commission or commodity commissions in general. Thank you.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tammy Denny. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Wheat Growers League. I do not have anything of substance to add at this moment in time, but I'm here to answer any questions that you might have as staff.
Okay. Well, my first question would be, whoever wants to take it, is what do you believe is enhanced by the passage of this legislation for the commission?
I see one thing that's going to be enhanced is by adding one of the items in here is to add industry members into the commission. I think to have that perspective on the commission will definitely help us make decisions for the wheat industry into the future. We've talked about adding maybe a co-op member or a wheat buyer that exports our wheat to neighboring countries. Having that perspective on the commission will definitely give us a better perspective of how to make our industry grow into the future and how to hand it over to the next generation.
Okay. Then another question, Mr. Stemmers and I had talked about this, and maybe you could clarify it for the committee about your appointment or disappointment of public members on the commission. Could you explain that to somebody?
It's really not a disappointment. We've had some great public members here in the past.
Well, not disappointment, but
non-appointed.
Okay. What it does just gives the commission flexibility in the future if we do decide to go with a full refund.
Would you explain that? Because we got people listening, homeowner, and what you're talking about, so that'd be helpful.
No, that's fine. Right now we are taxed. We're taxed 5 cents for every bushel that we grow. That since it is a tax, it comes under the Department of Agriculture, and it is comes under, I guess, the legislative oversight of the Oregon Department of Agriculture and Department of Justice. If through the freedom of speech, if we decided to refund all of our money to the producers, that portion of the 5 cents could be refunded back to the producers. Anything that is used for speech, for
campaigns,
that could be refunded back to the producer, which would eliminate our need to have the public member on the committee. But I don't see that happening here in the near future, but that gives us the opportunity to do that.
Anybody else want to add to that?
Well, Mr. Chair and committee, I don't want to dredge up the whole revisit of 2003, the legislation that was basically crafted as a result of some national cases dealing with checkoff programs.
Right.
And basically, the Attorney General's office worked with a number of the commodity commissions in Oregon and tried to put something in law that, in case of a court challenge, the commissions had as much strength as they could demonstrate to show that they were indeed government entities. One of those dealt with refundability or not refundability. And if you're a commission that doesn't offer refundability, the Attorney General's office thought it would be important to have a public member person on the commission. If a commission chooses to offer refundability, then basically the Attorney General had said, you don't need to have that public member. So basically what this change in the Wheat Commission statute does is clarify that if indeed a refundability is offered, the commission does not any longer need to have a public member on. I think if we got to that place, and I would agree with Jeff, I don't think that the industry has any intention in the future of doing that, but we wouldn't say to the public member, you're no longer on the commission. Probably what would happen is we just let the term run out and then not reappoint a public member to the commission.
Okay, that was good. Questions? Senator Berger.
Mr. Chair, I'd just like to make a comment of my appreciation of the wheat growers in Oregon and the Wheat Growers League. I'm glad they're here today. I have learned a lot more about your industry and what you contribute to Oregon, but as well as the industry, the great people who grow wheat in Oregon. I have to tell you, you're a great group of people, and I appreciate you.
Thank you. Okay, any other questions? Okay, I'm going to close public hearing, open a work session. Folks, we can't send this to floor yet. We haven't got the fiscal on the amendment. So what I would like to do is we have a dash 2 and a dash 3 amendment, is amend the bill. That way fiscal will, the bill will go off. They will give us the fiscal, and then we can move the bill next week.
So do we need to adopt the dash 1?
The 2 and the 3. The 3 is a redo of the dash 1, is my understanding.
So, Mr. Chair, I move the dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 639.
Senator Starr has moved the dash 2 amendment to Senate Bill 639. The objection?
Order. Mr. Chair, I move the dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 639.
Senator Starr has moved the dash 3 amendment to Senate Bill 639. Any objection to that? So order. Okay. We'll bring this back next week after fiscal tells us what we've done. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 639. Mr. Stenberg, do you want to tell us about tomorrow?
We're going to revisit Senate Bill 127, the one that came back to us from your colleagues on the floor. And we also have several bills on all-terrain vehicles.
The 127, colleagues, you may remember, was the suspension when you're involved in an accident. And what we have decided to do with your concurrence is that was a Section 10 issue. We're just not going to do Section 10. We're just going to go back to the original law, and we'll send the bill back out if that's the wish of the committee.
Yeah, we did.
And we'll talk about that issue another time.
And you want to come back to this one a different time?
And we'll come back to that one at a different time.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. We're here. Yep.